Historia Canadiana is recorded on the unceded lands of the Kanien'kehá:ka First Nation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Historia Canadiana, the show where we talk about literature, history, and people in the Canadian sphere. Today, we have a very special guest with us. We have Dominique Prinet, who was working as a bush pilot in Yellowknife. Dominique earned enough money to pay for his electrical degree, his electrical engineering degree, I should say, at the University of British Columbia, and eventually an MBA from McGill University. Very impressive. He went on to enjoy a long career in aviation, including with Montreal's Nordair, Canadian Airlines, and Air Tanzania. In retirement, Dominique started his own sailing school in Vancouver and even obtained his helicopter license at age 70. He is currently working on more stories highlighting his various experiences in Central and South America, Africa, Asia, and even across the Atlantic in a sailboat. Today, we are here to talk about his new book, Flying to Extremes, which concentrates on his time as a bush pilot in the Northwest Territories. Dominique, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having invited me.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for coming. So just, I guess, getting the most obvious question out of the way first, how would you describe your book for someone who might not be aware of it, right? Or who's coming into it for the first time?
It's a book of a fascinating period of Canadian history where the North was in full swing and being discovered and opened up in the 60s. And I was part of this lucky group who was helping with the process and flying bush planes on floats in the summer and skis in the winter, and bumming around the Arctic, taking all kinds of people to all kinds of very strange places in sometimes difficult conditions. So the book is a description of some of the particularly challenging flights that I had to conduct during that time.
Right. It really is quite an interesting book to read. And I like your use of the term bumming around, right? It's one of the things that I enjoyed most about the parts that I read is that it doesn't seem to be work for you, right? You officially did this to pay for your studies, as we said, but the way you write about these things, it doesn't feel like it was work. There seems to be a genuine passion in this whole affair, in this writing that's coming through. And I really appreciated that about your book. Yeah.
That was what was so thrilling about these years. It was every flight was a new experience. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating that the variety of sceneries I was meeting, from the Rockies to the ice cap to the Arctic islands to the tundra, the wilderness, and all the small communities and the people, I just loved it. In fact, I felt sometimes embarrassed because they were paying me for doing that, and I would have gladly paid to be able to fly in this environment.
Oh, so absolutely.
It was very hard, but absolutely thrilling. It was very exciting, excited doing it.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, even as someone like me who's an English major, right? I spend my life inside reading, right? That's pretty much my life. I envy you so much for just the experience that you would have been able to lead in that sense. Absolutely. So you've led, as we've just established, right, what many considered would be a very privileged, right, life in a sense, right? You've well lived, you're able to travel the world, right? Much more than many people can say. What made you want to write about that part of your life in particular, right? What drew you back to it after all these years?
Those were the years where I felt happiest and most enthused, and especially when coming out of this, what I thought was a very painful environment in Europe, very old traditional academic family going back 500 years on both sides, very demanding environment, very difficult to survive because of all the preconceived ideas and the bureaucracy and the traditions. And I just got out and discovered Canada. And I was really enthused. I couldn't believe my luck. I thought, finally my life started. But during my life, I was so busy, I never had a chance to write about it. So when I finally stopped doing much in terms of teaching or managing airlines, then I finally took the time to write down the stories from the notes that I had taken at the time.
Right. So that kind of leads us into the next question in a very interesting way. So as we were saying, right, France at the time felt very restrictive, right?
Yes.
Which is pretty funny in a sense, because right around the 60s is when you had like the student uprisings that were starting and all that. So there were some changes happening, but maybe not enough for you, or you wanted a different type of freedom, right? The freedom that the Canadian North allowed. And so why Canada, I guess, in all places? Because there were other parts of the world that, as you said at first, were kind of being opened up, right? You could have gone to the Arctic, I don't know, or even the Russian North. What particularly drew you to Canada, right?
Well, you have an excellent point. The young people were beginning to revolt, but I was so tied up in the Latin Quarter, downtown Paris, in the university environment, by such a conservative family and all the friends and relatives. So I couldn't participate in this freedom movement, which exploded in 68 with the 68 revolution in Paris. But I didn't know the movement existed, but I was part of it without even knowing it and feeling very miserable. So I decided just back up and go as far as away from this environment and from my family and hide in shame, because I hadn't entered some of the very elite schools where my life had been planned for 20 years and I didn't get in. So I felt ashamed, embarrassed, uncomfortable. And I said, well, look, I'm just going to pack up and go. So I fled the country. Didn't matter where I went. I went as far as I could, which was on the west coast of Canada. And I chose Canada for two reasons. First, to get lost in the forest and become a logger instead of...
Okay, so that was the original plan. It
wasn't to get lost. Nobody knew who I would be and about my family, and I would become a logger. So it's because of the wilderness of Canada that I went there, and also because when I was a young man on Atlases, I saw the Pacific, and I associated the Pacific with white beaches and coconut trees and young half-naked women surrounded by colors of flowers and welcoming the visitors with songs and guitars. So I said, well, I'm going to combine that, go to Vancouver, and I'll have the coconut trees and the young naked girls together with the bush where I can be a logger. So I landed in Vancouver in January.
Oof.
and I looked out the window and said, well, where are all the young women and the flowers and the guitars? And so I didn't move for a while. And then the flight attendant came in and said, well, we have a ride. I said, it can't be Vancouver. He said, yeah, that's it. You've got to get out. So I was just totally baffled, but it was too late to go back because I only had $200 in my pocket and no return ticket. So I was there. I had to do something. So I looked for a job as a logger. Mm-hmm. And of course, the logging camps were closed. So the only other thing I knew how to do, since I didn't have any, I have some university training by that, but not much, not enough, no degree. So the only thing I knew was to fly airplanes. So I found a guy who was good enough, and that amazed me with Canada. He talked to me. I was looking for a job as a logger. So I went to see the bossman of a logging company and talked to him. And he said, well, we can't hire you. But so he talked about airplanes, and he lent me $400, which is the equivalent of maybe $4,000 or $5,000 now.
Yeah, it's pretty substantial.
So I could transfer my French licenses into the Canadian ones. And without financial support, without any backing, I said, you just believed in me and lend me the money, I could get on my license. So within a few weeks, I knocked on doors and got a job as a bush pilot up and down the BC coast. And that was the start of a new life. That was when I started blossoming and opening up, and I finally had found my way.
Right. What I'm curious, this is not one of the questions I had planned, but hearing you talk about it, like, what clicked in you about flying a plane in the bush? Like, what did that ignite in you? Like, can you describe that sentiment of perhaps flying for the first time, and why that was so special to you rather than perhaps logging?
Right. It came in by accident. When I was desperate for a job, I was going around the airport every morning, starting at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, knocking at doors and looking for a job in an airline. I wanted to fly big airplanes.
Right.
But at the time, I couldn't get a job with an airline, so I found one which hired me, and it turned out to be a small airline using single engine and twin engine airplane. So I got a job flying there, and that was not really bush flying, because we're doing a lot of scheduled flights up and down the coast. It was flying in the wilderness, even on landing on logging strips once in a while, or small bush strips. And I thought this kind of flying was absolutely thrilling, because the pilot is free and makes his own decision. So I just loved it. And that's how I got started in the bush flying, not really bush flying, but flying in small strips and lots of funny places, where in Europe you'd go to jail if you landed there.
Right. It's very funny to me to imagine, right? We like to think that, you know, the 60s or 70s were a relatively modern time, right? It's about, what, 60 years ago? It's not that long ago in the grand scheme of history. But, you know, the way you describe arriving in Canada and the North, it's almost like the Wild West, right? It's a Northern Wild West. And as you're saying, people just kind of trusted you, loaning you, as you said, $400 at the time, and say, try it out. And the pilots are left up to their own devices. It's a very different way of conceiving how we understand of the 60s.
Yes, and that in the 60s, well, nothing much was happening in Europe, because it's such a conservative, and you can't get anything moving. Whenever I was trying to do in Europe, I was always told why it couldn't be done. It had never been done before, and it couldn't be done. And it was no all the time. And I was totally stuck. No matter what I tried, I was helping a flying club. I wanted to expand the flying club, do something different. It couldn't happen.
Right.
When I came to Canada, and when I went to the Minister of Transport, I asked for the equivalence of my French licenses.
Right.
And I was expecting the guy to laugh at me and say, well, there's no such thing as an equivalent. You've got to start from scratch, and it cannot be done.
Mm-hmm.
And the Transport Canada fellow looked at me and said, well, that's interesting. I don't know how to do it, but I'll find out and we'll find a way. I couldn't believe it. And he went around and he came back after discussing and said, well, this is what you have to do, and we'll help you. And these are the documents, and this is where you can get your training to get some flight tests. And I went back to the guy for more help, and because I had to write all the exams one after the other. And this civil servant, I think his name was John Kennedy. He must be, if he's still around, he must be 90 or more.
Right.
He took me under, that's a civil servant. He took me under, and he invited me to his home when I didn't know anybody here. And he invited me to his home for supper. That's how helpful a civil servant is. Just, it's a different world.
Yeah.
This is why I was so thrilled.
And then I
get a job with a company up in Powell River flying small airplanes. And first flight, he puts me on with one of their commercial pilots to fly a scheduled flight to Comox and I don't know, Victoria, someplace like that, and back. And then he gives me another flight to do without any other co-pilot, and then another flight. And then he tells me, well, you'll sleep in a little cabin we have in the woods. So I continue the next day and do a bunch of flights. And on the third day, he told me, well, this is where you're flying today. And I said, well, how many days do you think you're going to test me to see if I'm suitable? Oh, he said, you're in. The guy hasn't even seen my licenses. He could tell I could fly, but he'd never seen a paper, and he didn't even know my name. Well, in France, when you look for a job, the first thing they ask you, from what major school you come from what university, and the next question they ask you is, what was your father doing for a living?
Because that's important.
Because that's important. What kind of family do you come from? But here, they didn't give a damn about whether I had finished high school or not, or what my father was doing. They just wanted to know if I could do the job. And then I was in.
Yeah. Which
that's day and night. It's a thrilling for a young man who was stifled all his life and couldn't do anything. Now you in Canada, you can do whatever you want as long as you don't bother anybody and you don't break anything.
Right. And I can't, having grown up in the late 90s, I can't imagine that happening now in Canada, however, right? There's kind of been this change, I think, but it comes with time, I guess, but it's so fascinating to me to hear that story and to see how things have changed a bit. Yeah.
Well, you're saying it can't happen, but it's still happening. It's still open. People are still open-minded. People are still helpful.
Sure.
And so it's exactly the opposite of what it is still in Europe. Maybe things are not as easy now as they used to be because there are more people. So more people try to beat the system. So, but it's still extraordinarily easy and efficient and effective. And it's a wonderful place to be.
I would agree. Yeah. Okay. So getting into the actual book, right? Flying to Extremes. So how would you describe the way you chose to frame the story? Right? Because I only had parts of it. So would you say it's more of a narrative where you as a main character evolves through these hardships? Or did you choose to focus specifically on these events as independent and then just explain how wild these moments were? Right?
That's what I did. At the end of each flight, whenever I had time, because sometimes we had flights one after the other, but as soon as I had a break, I'd take a whole bunch of notes to remember the facts, the dates, the places, and the names of the people, and I stored them. So it was prevented as a list of events, which I thought was quite extraordinary. I'd never heard that it was possible to fly like these in these conditions and get away with it. As I say, in France, I would have been put in jail after the first one.
Yeah.
So I was thrilled, and I wrote about each story. Mm-hmm. And so I had all those notes, but I never had time until recently to put them together into histories. At the time, I published them in a French magazine for several years,
about
20 or 30 stories. Individual events.
Right.
But then I never had the time to put them all together into a book form. So that's the answer. It is a series of short stories of events which baffled me.
Right. So from the beginning, you had in mind to eventually publish this, right? You weren't writing them down just for your own benefit, right?
Yes, I was publishing them at the time when I could in this aviation magazine. And it had, since it was so different from what they were doing in France, that it had a fair amount of success among young pilots because they couldn't believe, being used to the French system,
that
it'd be somewhere on Earth where you could fly and land on lakes, on rivers, on slopes, up on mountains, and carry Inuits and mixed passengers. I mean, it was just amazing.
Right, absolutely. So the actual, despite it being a very segmented book, as you're saying, one event after another, the writing, I think, is very, very good, a lot of these things. And it reads very much like a short story more than just a factual statement, about this is what I did. So there was one part that I read in particular, about a fisherman in distress at night on Victoria Island, So just to give an example, this is the first paragraph. Late one afternoon, I took a dozen American fishermen from Cambridge Bay to a campsite in Albert Edward Bay, about 50 miles northeast, where they would spend a few days fishing Arctic char. It was late in August, and I was flying a Gateway Aviation Otter on floats. And you go on to say, describing basically the passengers, who they are. Each event, right, you kind of create these characters and these moments and these settings that's very much, it almost seems like fiction, like you're writing fiction. I know it's not, but it's written in that style that makes it so much more enjoyable, right, to read. Is that something that you tried to do even in your early notes when you were writing it down, or is that something that came later as you were rewriting it for
that,
this
that
book?
That came later. When I took the notes and first published the articles, it was strictly flying adventures addressing pilots. And what took time is to give some historical or environmental background to the stories and explain the conditions when it happened and who were the types of passengers I was carrying and who were the people I was resupplying, the trappers, mm-hmm. the prospectors, the Inuits, the First Nations, bringing people, babies and supplies to them or flying them out. So I tried to explain the people and the conditions of the flight. And that's what took time.
Right. Did you have any, you say it took time, but did you find it difficult to try to think back of these things, or is it so ingrained in your memory that it just came flowing back easily?
It came very naturally because it was so important. Those years were so, so important to me and so fascinating, and I loved them so much. Mm-hmm. But it's engraved, and I really enjoy writing about it and trying to put it in book form because it reminded me all those absolutely extraordinary people that I met. The people in the North are fascinating, whether they're the explorers themselves, the trappers, the prospectors, the Europeans, mm-hmm. who are all a bit like me, misfits, and try to get lost in the North.
Yeah.
My colleague Martin Hartwell, for instance, who got lost and survived by eating the nurse, he was also a misfit trying to escape from. So the Europeans are fascinating, and the native people are even more fascinating. The First Nation people, mm-hmm. and the Inuits, they're absolutely wonderful, and I just loved watching them and listening to their stories. And thinking that those people are in the right. They know how to live. They've been living it for thousands and thousands of years. The First Nation people for something like 12,000 years.
Yeah.
The Inuits for 4,000 or 5,000 years. And they know how to live. They've found a way to do it in harmony with nature.
Yeah.
And it works.
We should
look at them and try to emulate them and think about how to live with nature and how to survive. It's a totally different concept. And it's the people, to me, who made all the difference.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about that a bit later. I have a few questions about that. But just before I forget about the idea of the writing of the stories and stuff like that. So, to me, whenever you say something like this, it's almost as if the very idea that these people, whether they were First Nations or Inuit or the Europeans, right, by the very fact that they were there, that they had adapted or lived there, felt like they were characters in and of themselves, right? Fully fleshed and interesting in their own right, right? And I think that's something that you managed to capture wonderfully in this book, right? Even if you sometimes, or perhaps in the versions I have, don't go into a lot of detail, I think that's part of the beauty of the writing, is that you don't need necessarily that much detail to create like a really interesting and engaging character of any of these people, as you say, right?
Yes, it's not a book on history or socioeconomics. It's a book
of
adventures. So I I talked about the people and the environment just enough to give some background, but those are really flying stories. So I don't want to encroach into somebody else's territory and get into concepts with which I'm not thoroughly familiar.
Of course.
I'm not a social person describing the way of life over there. It's just to give a background to the stories.
Right. So to me, right, again, thinking about the book as a thing, as a product, or as a like a collection of stories, I should say, right? It felt to me at least that there was something in it for everyone. Right. Did like you have, as you say, stories of adventure, you have some that are almost border on thriller, right? Because of the intensity that you describe of some of the actions happening of people with frozen members and or engines failing, et cetera, right? Or having to land in some really precarious situations. Even a bit of, we'll get to that later, a story about a new baby, as we were saying. There seems to be something in it for everyone. Was that something that you had in mind of trying to make your experiences as accessible for everyone? Or did you want to describe it as you experienced it? And then if people would enjoy it, then great.
Well, it happened. I did it both. Initially, the stories were only about flying, and they were rather technical because they were addressing young people who were private pilots, members of flying schools or sailing clubs, sailing meaning gliders, and it was strictly technical and about airplanes. But when I put it together in a book form, I thought I should broaden the audience and give some background to make it more interesting to people other than strictly flyers. Mm-hmm. But the process changed when I put the book together, so I added some background to the stories, which were originally strictly technical.
Right. I'm curious, and then we'll get more into in-depth in the actual content of the book. In terms of publishing this piece, right, this work, did you find it difficult, or were people very interested from the start in actually seeing your work out in the world?
It went very easily. I looked for publishers who had shown some interest in those types of book. One came to mind, and he happens to be in close to Vancouver, and they've published over the last 40 years a number of books about the North and about flying and other adventures in BC. Mm-hmm. So I tried them and they said, sure, we'll take it. So success first time around. And that was about a year ago and it went very well. And now I just got out of the blue a request by a publisher in Quebec to publish the French version of it.
Oh, congratulations.
Not by itself also. So maybe next year we'll have a French version.
All right. We'll have you back on the show and do the interview in French.
Oh, perfect. I'd love that. Next year.
It's very interesting to me. While it is obviously, you describe it as a very straightforward experience of having it published, but it is a long process and you still need to look for a publisher that's interested in all that. But it's fascinating to me that you would so quickly at least find someone who's interested. Not that your book isn't interesting at all, but it's contrary to what a lot of people experience in the publishing world, right? And it's fascinating to me because it shows how interested people still are in imagining this wilderness, right, in Canada, or at least this idea of Canada in the North as something that's still not quite modern in a sense, right? That there's still these unknowns that we have to fully come to terms with. And I find that very interesting.
Yeah. Well, you're absolutely right. But I found two things. There is an audience which I never thought of, is the old folks about my age who like reminiscing.
Okay.
Because they were there, or I referred to events with which they which they remember from early years. And there's another group which I hadn't really thought of, as the Northerners themselves.
Right.
Because I mentioned a whole lot of people, and I get reaction every day. The little bookstore in Yellowknife alone has sold something like over 300 copies.
Of course. And,
just locally. And then because people say, I know this guy, oh, this was my aunt, or this was my grandfather. and so they're recognized. And I had a whole bunch of amazingly, people from the Inuit, from a tiny little community called Baichimo Harbor. Well, you never know where Baichimo is. It's northeast of Great Bear Lake, or maybe mostly east of Great Bear Lake, on the Arctic coast. And there's about six families living there in little plywood shacks. But most of them have moved to a bigger town, Cambridge Bay, for instance, on Victoria Island, or they moved to Coppermine or Yellowknife. And they now have access not only to electricities and oil furnaces and running water, but to the internet. Those are the people who are living literally in the Stone Age, in those little communities with no electricity, no radio, nothing. And now they have the internet, and they're absolutely amazed to see their pictures in the book.
Right.
And so I've got about a dozen fans in the North who ask me for the photos of their families, and they explained to me who is who. And now, if there is a second edition, I've got all the names of these people and how they're related.
Oh, that's so awesome.
So I've got ongoing conversation with readers scattered throughout the Arctic who are the Inuits, who at the time were living in tents and igloos.
Right.
The evolution is amazing.
Right. It's very, I love that, this book as a form of, as a work in progress, if you will, right? Or as a form of community building, in a sense, which I think is, oh, that's so great. Yeah, I love that. As you're saying, it would be there are so few books about the North, right, in general. There are some, obviously, but it doesn't come very often, right, especially not to a mass audience. And to have, I'm sure just the fact of having a book written about those experiences, let alone the fact that you actually know the people in it, would have been very appreciated in itself. Yeah.
Well, it was a very thrilling time with a lot of things happening and mining exploration throughout the Northwest Territories. The water resources were flying to check the water level and lakes and rivers and the flow of the rivers, and drilling holes through the ice in December to measure the water temperature. I mean, it's just madness. But so that was happening at the time, and there was the oil and gas exploration in the Beaufort Sea. There was some exploration oil and gas way up in the Arctic Islands, where I flew in 50 below weather in the dark in February, latitude 80 north. It was just a nightmare, this 1 week flight. But that was the kind of exploration being done at the time. And I was flying trappers and prospectors and sick patients and pregnant women who decided to have their baby in the middle of a snowstorm in December. You know, why don't you wait until a nice day in June? That was just at the time of the discovery of the diamonds.
Right.
And in fact, I threw prospectors where they eventually found diamond mines.
Okay.
Throughout the tundra. Mm-hmm. And there was a mad gold rush around Hope Lake, northeast of Great Bear Lake.
Yep.
There were thousands of prospectors over there. It went on for 2 or 3 days. And the little dirt strip in Hope Lake in the middle of the tundra close to Coppermine was busier than Chicago International Airport. It was a zoo up there, so it was so active. So it was really a very interesting time. And I guess it's nice that I had to get a chance to talk about it, because it may not happen again.
Of course. Yeah. So just to kind of return to a bit of the content of the book. So there are times in the writing when you talk about the work as a bit of a solitary experience, right? You're the pilot and you have to go somewhere. You're alone. And sometimes you have to deal with things when you're alone, right? And there are other times when you rely on others' experiences. We were talking in the story on Redstone River, right? Stood out to me of trying to remember what other pilots have done in a terrible situation, right? So do you feel like you are a part of a community of bush pilots that have gone through similar experiences as you and who can understand that? Or do you feel like your experiences that you're showing here are particularly unique in some way, right? Or not that one is better than the other, but I'm just saying, do you feel like you're more of a part of a community or that you are a bit of a trailblazer in this sense?
I never felt that I was part of a community of bush pilots. And I tell you why. Bush pilots are young men, and they like a lot of young men, they behave like cocks. They want to be better than others and show off and tell the world that they can do things that nobody else can do.
Of course.
So it was an unwritten competition, if you will, between pilots as to who could fly a larger load in worse weather. So it wasn't really a community, and between companies were competing with each other also as to who would handle the worst flights.
Right.
So it wasn't really a community, but what I felt, I was part of the larger northern community.
Right.
When I arrived into a small community, the people, and I flew to each community maybe two or three times per year. And when I arrived there, the people recognized me from the ground by the way I was turning around the community before landing on the sandbar or on the ocean or on the local river or lake. They recognized the company airplane. They thought it would probably be one pilot or the other. And they all came in. And I remember extraordinary flights to Coppermine on the Arctic coast, where literally the whole community came to meet the plane. Because I was bringing patients back from hospital, a young mother with a new baby, and I was bringing the mail, and I was bringing personal supplies that they had asked me very shyly to get from them 3 or 4 months before. They say, if you come back and you bring some thread or a piece of fabric, or one guy told me he was very shy about a small bottle of whiskey. And for them, it's very precious. They can't get it any other way.
Right.
So when I arrived, everybody comes in to meet the airplane. So I felt very much part of each community, and they would welcome me. And I'd go from house to house and talk about things with them, anything. Right. And then I would fly them to some other community if I happened to be flying there at no charge, because I was going there anyhow. So I was trying to help the local community. And so I was one of the northerners, more than one member of the bush pilot family.
Right. So that's, I think, one of the questions I had. You kind of already answered it, was because you brought up many times the story of the newborn baby, right? And you end that story by saying, the next day I flew the women back to her camp, or the woman back to her camp. I guess that eventually there must have been paperwork prepared for this adopted child, but I'm not even sure about that. This was Inuit country and ways were different. Right?
Yes. So it was quite fascinating. I was flying every day to an Inuit camp at the mouth of the Tree River on the Arctic coast. And I'd come in with a whole load of empty buckets, and they would just replace them by a full load of buckets full of fresh Arctic char that they had caught in their nest during the night. And one day there was a young woman who was loading full buckets of fish onto the airplane. And the next day, she was there again with another load of buckets full of fish, but I heard in the back a little baby cry. So I asked her, "Well, do you have a baby in the camp?" Oh, she said, "Yeah, it's my baby. It was born last night." and she was holding fish before giving birth and after giving birth, there was nothing to it.
Right.
And she said, well, I have a problem because I already have a baby and I can't feed two, so I don't know what to do with this one. And she said, well, can I come with you with the baby and can we take it to town? So town was Cambridge Bay on Victoria Island. So I said, right, sure, come over. And in town, I saw the manager of the fish co-op and said, look, I just came in with an extra lady and a baby. I don't know what to do with him. And he said, well, we'll adopt him. So he agreed to adopt him. And the next day, the woman went back to her camp without the baby, and the baby was adopted, and that was it. So I have no idea whether there was any paperwork, but that's the way you do it in the Arctic. If you can't handle a baby, you pass it on to another. In fact, from what I could see, the babies were raised by the community and would spend some time with one family and sometimes with another family. It was not my baby and my family, nobody can touch it. It's a community baby.
Right.
That's a different way of looking at it.
Of course.
It worked. The babies were all smiling and happy, and I never saw a baby crying in the Inuits. Mm-hmm. Don't make noise. They don't shout. They don't get angry. They're always smiling and people. They're amazing people.
Yeah. So that story in particular stood out to me in, and especially as it relates to this idea of community that we're talking about, to say that the element of community that you lived through almost emerged naturally. You didn't necessarily, although I'm sure you did, right, try to make friends or try, as you say, you went house to house and actually talked to people. It seems by the very nature of the job and just where you were that this type of mentality or this type of way of this way of life emerged quite normally and without much effort. And I find that very almost a reassuring part of the book, that despite these hardships that you're living through, that this sense of togetherness can come out of it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I didn't try to make friends or do anything special. Mm-hmm. It's a natural way of life. And I found I you know, having been brought up in Paris, France, on the left bank and Latin Quarter for 25 years, I only knew big city and intellectual life. And I discovered life closer to nature with small communities. And I was fascinated by the attitude of the people, the sense of community that they have, of a get together and helping each other and supporting each other. They share the food and they share the shelter and they share the kids and they help and they work together as very tightly knit communities. And it's a way of life which very impressed me. And that's, you know, we should look at these people and try to learn from them rather than try to make them work or live the way we do.
Right.
Because their philosophy of life is the way we should all try to live.
Right.
And there's a sense of the community in the North, which is very rewarding.
Yeah. I have an uncle who worked for a while up north as well, in similar communities, although the north of Quebec, right, not in the Northwest Territories. But he says exactly the same thing. There's so much to learn from those communities. And it's almost, he almost, when he talks about it, regrets the fact that there was that contact. While he does appreciate, right, what he learned from it, he almost regrets the fact that, you know, there's something that was lost, right, or destroyed in those communities that's perhaps that makes him feel not as great about his involvement in that. But yeah, I don't know if...
Yes, you're right. And we've all contributed unknowingly or unwittingly to the demise of the northern population, and in a sense, I feel bad. I feel guilty. I was part of it. I tried to help bringing food and supplies from the south, but in fact, I was part of those people who eventually destroyed their way of life. And in retrospect, the whole process was wrong. I think,
but right,
it's done. We it, There was no ill feeling or feeling of despair. On the contrary, it was a willing to help and be nice to them and admire them and respect them. But in the process, we damaged their way of life and hurt them. I have to live with it. That bothers me.
Mm. So I guess going off of that, there is a rather, we've kind of skirted around it through questions, but there's a very profound human element in the book, right, that I think you include that few books about the wilderness have, right? And I do think that what you're bringing up here is definitely an example of that, I guess you could say. Because a lot of books about the North, or even right, the Wild West, if you will, we made that comparison earlier, don't put as much emphasis on the human element as you seem to have, even though it is a book about flying. And how did you try to balance those aspects, right? How was it important for you to include those human aspects? Or again, did it just emerge naturally? Did you always see the wilderness as having that human involvement in it?
I arranged the flying stories to publish in the book, I tried to introduce the human element because I had so much respect and admiration for the way of life of the Inuits. Right. Those people have a kindness and openness and generosity and resilience, which is absolutely unbelievable. And they have a knowledge of nature and understanding of nature, which they've learned over thousands of years, very successfully. And to me, they're just ideal societies. And they live the way we should all try to live, except that it's hard to live like this in the South. So,
of course,
the human element was one of the areas that I enjoyed most in this flying. It was the technical part, but it's the people of the North who really fascinated me.
Right. Just to return for a moment to the actual writing of the story, there are some moments where I found myself laughing quite a bit, particularly if we want to go back to the Redstone River aspect of the book, where after describing this this event, right, in which you had to try to land in a rather difficult situation, you end with what I think is quite a funny moment where you say, we just give a moral basically to the reader and say, moral of the story, when a pilot tells you, don't worry, I've landed there myself, you should always ask how the flight ended. Which I thought was a very interesting addition. And I'm curious to know if that addition of humor, right, or at least a bit more of the lighter aspects of it, was a way for you to perhaps get over the fear that you were experiencing in some situations, right? Or if it's something that you added after many years of reflection and now you can laugh about it? Or was that something that from the beginning you were making light of certain situations?
Well, I've always tried, because I was brought up during the war. I went through 5 years of war, and then the 10 years after the war were not much better, except that we were no longer risking our life by just walking downtown. So I always tried to find the funny part of life. And during some of those flights, I tried to, as you say, remove some of the stress by trying to find the funny side of things. For instance, I remember flying in winter with an otter from Coppermine to Yellowknife. It was in the dark and it was blowing like hell in Coppermine. We took off from the Arctic Ocean on an otter and end up in the clouds and flying through the clouds and eventually over the clouds under the stars. And then the power failed and it was totally dark inside the airplane. I ran out of battery because the alternator was no longer working. I had no electricity. We had no lights inside the airplane, no lights outside, no more radios, couldn't talk to anybody, and no radio compass to tell me which way to go. So okay. We were on our own, under the stars, over the clouds, in the dark.
Very ideal situation.
And I didn't know which way to go, and I didn't know where we were, and I didn't know what to do, except that after 3 or 4 hours, we'd run out of fuel. 4 hours or 5 hours, we'd run out of fuel. And so we'd have to go down, and God knows where. But to check the engine once in a while, I had to light matches because it was so cold inside the airplane that my flashlight battery were frozen. Oh. So here I was, not knowing where we were, not knowing exactly which way we were going, and scratching matches to read the instrument. And I thought the whole scene was totally hilarious. It's the pilot using matches to read the engine instruments. And then a while later, I was trying to keep in a direction from what I thought was a planet, a bright thing in the sky, which was roughly, I thought, towards the south. Mm-hmm. And after a while, I realized that the whole sky had changed, but this planet was still in the same direction. And I panicked and I said, well, what happened? I realized the planet wasn't a planet at all. It was a satellite. It was a big echo. A huge echo satellite, which was like a very bright planet. So mm-hmm. I was following a satellite. Well, that was going to take me nowhere. So I had to change courses. And so I thought that was funny. And on another occasion, we're falling off the sky in an otter flying along the coast during the summer. Mm-hmm. And we ended up in the clouds because the clouds were too high. We couldn't go underneath them. It was right to the ground. We couldn't go above them. So we're in the clouds. And after a while, we started icing up, and I had to increase power and more power until I end up with takeoff power and takeoff flaps. Right. And we were going down, 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 and iced up. So I tried to call Mayday on the radio to announce where we were very roughly and come and pick up the pieces someday. And I was shouting in the mic because of all the engine noise, mm-hmm. and nobody gave a damn. And I discovered that the antennas were totally iced up. There was about an inch of ice on the antenna, so it was just a total waste of time. So I was shouting in the breeze. So I thought that was funny. And later on, as the altimeter was unwinding and we're going down towards the ground and we're going to hit it at cruising speed in the clouds with zero visibility, which is exactly what happened. As it was unwinding, and I felt sorry for the passenger. I had 10 passengers in the back. Really mm-hmm. felt sorry for them.
Of course.
And as the altimeter was unwinding and reached 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4,000 feet, my passenger, who woke up for a while, and he looked at the altimeter and then looked at the watch and leaned to me and said, are you sure it's 4 o'clock? I have 4:15. And I said, oh, don't worry. It's working backwards. And so it broke. So don't worry about it. I thought that was, the guy totally relaxed comparing the altitude with his watch and said, well, it's not quite the same. One is turning clockwise. The other one is turning counterclockwise. But then, so why worry? So those are the kind of episodes that I think are amusing and relaxing in a very stressful environment. So
of course.
That's how one can survive, is looking at the fun part of mm-hmm. the event.
Yeah, absolutely. And is that an outlook on life that you've kept with you even after leaving being a bush pilot? Yeah.
Okay. Yes, I found that very helpful to survive.
Right.
Look at the fun part. Isn't it amazing to be like that? And I always thought that if ever I fell off an airplane without a parachute, for instance, I'd say, well, isn't that amazing to be floating in midair like a bird and going down? I'd never done that before. This is a fantastic experience.
Oh, so, look, I can see the town over there. What a nice view.
Exactly. Yeah. So look at the funny. I mean, be careful and try to survive and mm-hmm. do all the right things. But look at the funny side of things. It helps.
Right. And aside from your perception, your use of humor, for example, in terms of survival, as you were saying, what other like, how did these experiences as a bush pilot inform the rest of your life, right? Either in the way you act or how you engage with other people, how has that shaped? Because you were relatively young, right? When you arrived here, you were, what, 25 when you came here? So that's very young. And so I would imagine it shaped your outlook on your life after, right?
I have a lot more tolerance about other people because of my contact with the First Nation and the Inuits. And what added to this tolerance is my old age, and that helps. And also my 5 years in Africa, where I met another group of people who think and live in manners which are reminiscent of the way the First Nation Inuit live, close to nature and not stressed by the time. So that has helped in my life, I think, this contact with the First Nations.
Okay, absolutely. No, that's beautiful.
And also, it helped me plan each event, because before each flight, I had to spend a lot of time planning, what if the ice is not thick enough when I arrive? What if I run into bad weather? How far can I go before I have to turn around and come back? And beyond the no return point, where do I stop if things go wrong? And where do I find fuel? So it's this planning, which is useful when you go out on expeditions, climbing expedition or explorations, for instance, a trip across Africa with a little Jeep. What if, what do you do? So it makes life a little bit safer when you've got a plan.
Right.
I think that's what I learned from it.
Yeah, which I think is another funny moment, because the way you were describing your first experiences when you first arrived in Vancouver was a very loose way of doing things in a sense, right? Oh, you got the job, you don't need a permit, just kind of things like that. And it's very funny that in that environment that is less rigid, as you were saying, than in France at the time, that's the moral that you would learn of being assiduous, or at least planning ahead, right? It seems almost contrary or opposite.
Well, I was complaining about the bureaucracy.
Of course.
The paperwork.
Right.
And there is a freedom of action in Canada, which is amazing compared to what it is in the old country. This having been said, then I think it's important, if you're going to take advantage of this freedom of rules and regulations and restrictions, to make sure you know what you're doing. And yes, it's all very good to say, well, I can land on a logging road with a twin-engine airplane sneaking in between the trees, or I can land on the ice on the river and hope the ice is thick enough. That's the freedom of bureaucracy. But then it gives us individually more responsibility. We become liable, so we can't hide behind rules and regulations. We take the risk and we assume liability. Mm-hmm. And that's something which is important for all of us. Assume the liability of our actions. Don't hide until behind somebody else. It happened. And if you're the boss of that department, or if you're the pilot, then that's your responsibility. Maybe you couldn't help it, but you have to deal with it and try to fix it, make sure it doesn't happen again.
Of course. And do you miss your time as a bush pilot, or was it enough after a while?
I don't miss it, because it was too hard. Right. That's something that you can do when you're in your mid-20s and you're young and innocent and a little bit irrational and ready to risk your life, and life doesn't matter. As you age, as you mature, life and the life of others, if you have a family, becomes increasingly important.
Right.
And you worry about risking your life for no serious reason. It's not worth it. So I'd be unable to do it now. So I wouldn't have the nerve to do any of the things that I did at the time when I was a bit innocent.
Right. I can imagine. So I'm curious, right, because you mentioned that you, when you first arrived here at the beginning of the interview, you mentioned that you were part of a particularly interesting moment in Canada's history, right, in which we were expanding up north, right, in various ways. Do you see yourself as an active, I guess, historical agent, if you will, in this whole setting? Like, where do you see yourself in the history, or even the, now that you're a writer, in the literary tradition of Canada, right? Because you very much, to me at least, approach what we see as travel literature, which is a huge thing here in Canada. There's a long history of that, right? And your book very much approaches that in a way.
Well, the two things. I think I contributed to the development of the North, mm-hmm. although I contributed to the demise of the Native people.
Sure.
But I was part of the group of maybe pioneers is too much of a word, but in the 60s, flying up north was fairly harsh, and there were no radio beacons, there were no GPS. Trying to find your way on the maps was very difficult because the maps were only black and white, or blue and white, with no, but they contained a lot of errors and a lot of blank spots and
right.
no elevations or little elevation. So I was part of that movement. Mm-hmm. But subsequently, when I was in other jobs, for instance, working on the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, I made a contribution there when I was at Nordair. And I expanded or doubled the size of the network of the airline by expanding from Montreal and Ottawa to get authority to fly to Toronto, Sault Ste. Marie, Thunder Bay, Dryden, Winnipeg.
Okay.
I thought that was quite a moment, and so it made a contribution. I think to some degree when I was at Canadian Airlines, I made a contribution too. I made a contribution when I was at Air Tanzania, turning around and managing the airline for 5 years and taking it out of bankruptcy. So throughout my life, I think I have the feeling that I had made some positive contribution, not just the flying in the north.
Right, absolutely. It sounds like it. And I guess going off of that, are there any other writing projects about any of these other aspects that you're planning? Because I would love to hear about personally your experiences in Africa and Asia and all that, like, or even as a sailor, as a sailing pilot.
I'm writing, but not, I guess it's not for public consumption, just for the pleasure of writing, because I've always loved writing.
Mm-hmm.
I relive those situations and reminisce, and I just love, just like if I was talking to somebody about it. So I really enjoy the writing. So for myself, I'm writing some of those parts of my life which I thought was really exciting. For instance, in September 44, when we were hiding in the family castle, a 12th century castle in the east of France in the basement, and for 3 days and three nights, the front was there. The Germans were occupying the castle. The Americans were attacking the hill with tanks. And that was an experience. I was 5 years old, but it struck me. And so, or living in Paris during the occupation, or crossing Africa with a small jeep over a period of months, mm-hmm. or crossing the ocean with a sailboat and finding my way with a Saxon. I thought that was fun. Or flying around North, Central, and South America with a small two-seater over a period of several months was fun, or crossing Nepal on foot, or bombing around Malaysia and Indonesia in the jungle. Those were fun moments that I found very interesting, sometimes a bit terrifying. So that's what I'm writing about now. It's those moments, but I'm not sure anybody would be interested. So it's just for the pleasure of writing, and maybe for my grandchildren if they're interested.
I mean, you'd have one reader here. I can say that. Just before we end, I'm curious, is there anything that you wanted to add that maybe we didn't talk about today? Anything that you wanted to mention as a particularly important part of this book that you wanted to bring up, that you think our audience would like to know about, perhaps?
One one audience I was trying to reach, mm-hmm. and I don't know how to reach it, are the young people who are about 20 years old in a state of despair, the way I was when I was 20 and failed to enter those top physics schools in France. It's just like entering a physics master's or PhD program at Oxford or at MIT. It's just very difficult. Yep. I had a sense of total failure, and I was down, and it was just awful that I remained in this situation for 4 or 5 years. It was just awful until I left, and then I opened up. So the market I would really love to reach are the young people who are in the same situation, and it happens to a lot of young people who don't know where they are, who don't know who they are, who don't know where to go, have no sense of future and direction, and are desperate, and especially among the native people, because they're caught between two civilizations. Mm-hmm. So to those people, I say, look, try to find something which you would really like to do, and do it with enthusiasm, and never mind the family and what they say and what they think, and never mind your teachers and friends and relatives. If you have a passion, whether it's dancing or writing or exploring or doing whatever it is, just go ahead and do it, but do it with passion. Be a fanatic about it, and then you will recover. Pull up your socks. It can be done. And if you're passionate enough, you will go through the barriers and make it work and make a success. And it is thrilling to succeed in what you love doing. It's thrilling. As I said, they were paying me for doing something which I've gladly paid to do because it was so exciting. That was what I wanted to do. And so don't give up. Pull up your socks and go to it, whatever you think you want to do. That's the thing you should be doing. And don't worry about what people think. Just do your thing, and it will work out.
Wonderful. So where can people find Flying to Extremes? Is it available across Canada? Or?
Yes, it's available. It has a publisher, Hancock House in BC. So it's available by order in a bookstore. Some larger retailers might have a copy, but usually they're on order. If you're in the north, you get it from the bookseller at bookstore in Yellowknife. There's hundreds of them already. They have it in stock. Another source would be the Aviator's Bookshelf. It's an online store in BC which mails books on aviation, and they've sold lots of my books. From the publisher itself, Hancock House in British Columbia, they mail books too. And you can order it through Amazon, and next year you'll be able to read it in French. In the meantime, you can read it also from Amazon in electronic format.
Okay.
So it's widely available.
Fantastic. Well, Dominique, thank you very much for coming on and telling us about not only your book, but honestly, just these wonderful experiences that you've had and just how it changed your outlook on life. It was very appreciated. And I hope to have you again sometime, again, maybe to talk about the French version of your book.
Absolutely. It was very, I enjoy your question. It was very well done. Thank you very much.